Class is in session. You're listening to Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horshake.
Let's go!
Now, let's start the show.
Podcast listeners, thank you so much for checking out today's show. This is episode 52 of the Squat University podcast. The goal with each and every one of these shows is to bring you as much value-packed content to help you move better in the gym and in life, decrease your body's aches and pains, and help you reach your true athletic potential. Now, before we get started, I just wanted to remind you guys about my two upcoming Squat U seminars. April 13th and 14th, I'll be in Waterford, Ireland, and June 1st and 2nd. Kansas City, Missouri, here in the U.S. And day one of that June seminar is CEU eligible for those out there who are members of the NSCA. So you can just sign up for those at squatuniversity.com under the seminar tab. Now, for today's podcast, I am joined by Eric Helms. Eric is a coach, bodybuilder, and powerlifter, as well as an amazing author. His educational background is in fitness and wellness, with a master's degree in both exercise science and sports nutrition, as well as a PhD in strength and conditioning. Today's podcast dove deep into the science of sticking points when lifting heavy. I hope you enjoy it, and without further ado, here is today's interview. Eric, thank you so much for coming on the Squat University podcast. For those out there that do not know of you and all the work that you do, can you take a second and introduce yourself?
Well, first, huge honor to be here. So thank you for having me. So real simply, I'm just a dude who fell in love with lifting weights, had a very positive experience with it, changing my life for the better, and I'm now trying to kind of pay that forward. My background is that I got on the competitive natural bodybuilding stage for the first time in 07. I got on the platform as a powerlifter first time in 06. I have been on the platform as a weightlifter, although I feel like there should be air quotes around that based on my skill level and performance. But I'm just a strength athlete, a physique athlete who, fell in love with both the mental side of it intellectually and experientially. And have taken that as far as I can in academia, as a coach, and keep taking it further, and as a science communicator. So fast forward to 2019, I'm a research fellow at AUT, which is Auckland University of Technology here in New Zealand, where I did my PhD in strength and conditioning. So I work with master's and PhD students now. I'm also the head of research and development at 3D Muscle Journey, our coaching collective for natural bodybuilders. I have a monthly research review, Mass, with Greg Knuckles and Mike Zerdos. I've gotten my books with Andy Morgan and Andrew Valdez. And so I'm science communicator, athlete coach, and professional nerd, essentially.
There you go. I love having professional nerds on the podcast because we get to nerd out about a bunch of things on here. So I first learned of a lot of your stuff through Mass with you and Greg. And it's just amazing the stuff that you guys put out. Basically, we were just talking. We're able to take these very complex studies that are put out every single day through the, I guess you could say, the ivory tower way of doing things, you know, going through the scholastic way and publishing in medical journals. But you're able to take it and make your research in a way that everyone can understand. So sort of empower the everyday individual. And that's something I can definitely connect with. And sort of the point of Squat University is to help empower everyone on a level that they can understand, but, you know, through the actual science and research out there, so they can understand the most up-to-date information to help improve their performance, cut down on injuries, and help them find sort of their true strength that they're capable of. So I think today what I wanted to start about talking about was sticking points in the lift. I know if anyone has been lifting for more than a couple of years and you've been lifting heavy, you've come across this frustration in your lift where you are attempting to lift something heavy and you just come up short halfway up or at the very bottom. You reach this point where the lift just does not want to proceed anymore. So let's jump into the science of this and talk about sort of what is a sticking point? Why does it occur?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. And this is something that is really prominent, especially in powerlifting practice. Like, there's not many powerlifting coaches or paradigms that don't give at least some attention to the idea of training that sticking point or sticking region. But, you know, funny enough, in the research and kind of the evidence side of it, there's not that much attention to it in kind of the broad scheme or comparison. And if you really want to dig in and get dirty and look at it in the way of like, okay, I'm an evidence-based quote unquote strength athlete person, you're looking at two papers by the same couple guys. I believe in the names, I got it written down here because I always get it wrong, Kampf and Andrew Lojovic, and I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. I think I pronounced it differently in the mass video I did. But clearly these two, they do a deep dive in these two reviews, and they're both open access. You can look them up, and I'm sure we can put it in the podcast notes.
Yep.
And they really attack it from all angles. And they bring in pieces of physiology and biomechanics. And they give an operational definition of what a sticking point is, what we should probably use as a definition, at least in research. And then I personally think we should use a different definition in practice, because they're looking for something that can be objectively defended and not have any logical holes in their definition, rather than something that has utility, like you said, for empowering people. So, So they define a sticking point as the point where if you took a set to failure, that's where you'd get stuck. Okay. Because there are operational definitions based on the point where velocity is the lowest or force is the lowest, which have potential problems. Because there's sometimes when you're intentionally slowing down a lift by transitioning from the top of the concentric back down and out, where obviously it's not where it's the most difficult. Because of the force velocity relationship, when force is lowest, it actually is when velocity is the highest, which is when it's easiest. So that doesn't make any sense. That kind of falls apart. But anyway, this is a pretty good definition, because if you were to take a set to failure, you would kind of be around the point where your weakest link is. But that doesn't mean that you need to go to failure to find out your sticking point. In a practical sense, your sticking point is essentially where the lift feels the hardest. And I would say at least moderately heavy loads, because it can change a little bit. It's not until you start to see velocity drop off a little bit do you start to feel that lag is like, oh, that's actually quite hard. Like if I pushed it any further, I'd get stuck there. That point or that region where you are clearly working harder than anywhere else and there's a visible slow in bar speed that's not intentional, that's where your sticking point or sticking region is. And that is going to be the quote unquote bottleneck where anyone, when they do push it beyond failure or think, you know what, for my third attempt, I'll go up 2.5 kg and they miss. So long as there wasn't a technical fault, it's probably going to occur there. So that's what a sticking point is. And I don't know if I could let you prompt me the next question. Or I could roll right into it.
Yeah. I mean, is there any variability, I guess, that you see in where those sticking points occur from person to person?
Yes.
And
yes.
Well, I guess what are the main reasons that would cause a difference, or do we know what the main reasons that would cause a difference in that variability?
Perfect. Yeah. I'm glad I let you speak instead of monologuing, because I was just going to ask myself that same question.
Yeah.
And then I realized this is a podcast. You can actually have a discussion with the host. monopolizing it. So yeah, defining it is one was the first small hurdle, but then actually figuring out why these occur. You know, basically, anytime you hear someone who gives you a very black and white, clear-cut answer, they're oversimplifying it.
Yeah,
it's a little more complex than that. And anytime you think you've got a handle on the universal reason for the sticking point in a given lift, you see someone who breaks that rule. Like one thing you'll hear, for example, in the powerlifting community is deadlifts, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're doing conventional deadlifts, you're going to be strong off the floor. Hard to lock it out, right?
Yeah.
That's a conventional deadlift. That happens to everybody. And if you do sumo, you got to be patient. It's going to come off the floor slow. And then as soon as you get it, you know, up to the shins and knees, you blow it out of the water. Mm. And then you think of like four people who have trouble locking out a sumo deadlift. And you're like, what's going on there? And someone goes, it just got forward on them. You know, it drifted away from the knee. And like, maybe. But it's actually a lot more complex than that. And people do have different individual sticking regions. And lifts have individual sticking regions. And there are essentially two main categories of rationale or underpinning determinants of that. There's what I would call physiological, and there's what I would call biomechanical. Okay. So on the physiological side of it, we're looking at essentially the length-tension relationship. which if I was to put this in really simple terms, is that when a muscle is close to resting length, there's the most opportunities for actin and myosin to bridge, mm-hmm. pull on one another, and create force production. If you're really, really short, and I don't know if there's video to this, but like if you're at the very top of a bicep curl, you're too overlapped and you won't be able to get as many cross bridges. And if you're all the way stretched, again, I'm showing like the very, very bottom end range of a bicep curl, there's, again, not as many cross bridges and you can't produce as much force. Now, that's easy to think about in a isolation movement like a bicep curl. When you're thinking about a squat, where you've got a bunch of different muscle groups all contributing to that force production, you have to think about, when are each one of the individual muscles at their optimal length tension relationship? And then you have to think about, all right, and what are the relative strengths and weaknesses of all of those muscles that contribute to that movement? So for example, like if you're doing a front squat, yeah, rock bottom, you're not going to have optimal length tension relationships in the quads or the glutes, which are arguably the prime movers. But then if you take someone and you give them a really long torso and that lever arm increases a lot, their quads and glutes might be ready to go, but they hit fatigue because they don't have the isometric erector strength and they dump the bar forward.
Makes sense.
Right. So now all of a sudden, it's not that simple, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing. That's the length tension relationship. But the length tension relationship actually is normally applied to isometric contractions. It's kind of a controlled look at it. So where you have the most cross bridges is defined on an isokinetic dynamometer where they can check all these different angles. And again, I'm showing a bunch of points in a bicep curl. Mm-hmm. But when you're using a dynamic contraction, so I'll go back to the example of a squat where you have a stretch shortening cycle, meaning the eccentric, the lowering phase, precedes the concentric phase, meaning you bounce out of the hole. We all know, let's say you're playing a pickup game in basketball and you're all waiting. Let's say you're playing 21, right? Mm-hmm. And someone just scored and you're all hanging out to try to get the rebound on their free throws. No one stands straight up, waits, and then just jumps without bending back down. Everyone gets a little down and up. And that's because that actually enhances your performance. That eccentric preload is like stretching a rubber band and allows you to get a stronger concentric contraction. That's why another powerlifting example, if you do a triple on deadlifts, almost always that second rep is the easiest one out of the three.
Yeah.
The first one, you've got to get the inertia going off the floor. It's not even moving. And you're starting with a concentric, because unlike the squat, you're not lowering first. Pulling it off the floor feels like it's never going to move. Mm. Second rep, man, because you've already had a rep to then come back down to it, it flies up. Third rep, you're a little fatigued. It's hard. So now we have the whole stretch shortening cycle and length tension relationship involved on the physiology side. And when you have a dynamic contraction, concentric and eccentric, now you have not only the contribution of actin and myosin, but also the passive contribution. So the reason why that eccentric preceding a concentric gives you additional force is because of the elastic component of muscle. So that's the tendon being stretched and recoiled. Mm. And then also the intramuscular stuff, like the collagen matrix, and also the titin molecule, which is a non-contractile, however, force-producing molecule in a stretch-shortening cycle that kind of acts like an internal tendon, if you will. And that's an oversimplified explanation, but it gives you an elastic contribution. So now you have to think about, all right, what was the speed and rate of the eccentric contraction? Was there an eccentric contraction? Or are we talking about like a deadlift, one RM on a meet, and there is none? Mm-hmm. Overlapping with the length tension relationships. So that's the physiology side. Then the big one, and this is something where if you talk to, say, like a physical therapist or a biomechanist, they will emphasize this typically, because that's kind of where their paradigm of thinking is for the reason why mm-hmm. we'll see a sticking point, is the biomechanical side of it, which is really just lever or moment arm lengths. Easy way to think of it, again, is you come down to the rock bottom portion of a squat. And again, we said the glutes and the quads are the prime movers, right? So we got to think about the knee and the hip joint. And if we have the center of mass is right over midfoot, where the bar is also kept, we get to the very bottom of the squat and the hips are going to be the furthest back, the knees furthest forward as they are in that squat pattern. Then as you stand back up, the knees and the glutes, the knees and the hips come back towards the midline. right?
Yeah.
So we know the longer a lever arm, the harder it is to move something, the more effective force you have to generate, right?
Yeah.
So bottom of the squat, you've got the longest lever arms and the poorest length tension relationship. And that's why coming out of the hole is where most people stick.
Yeah.
Why not everyone? Well, I'll give you an example of when I first started training as an Olympic lifter and attempting that weightlifting thing. A good buddy of mine, Matty Madsen, placed in the top three, I believe, in Commonwealth Games. Very high-level lifter. The dude was in the 170s, clean and jerking at 77 kilos as a late teen, talking 19. So just an incredibly explosive, bouncy dude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm, you know, 10 years at least older than him. And you know that I said at least because it's more. getting into Olympic lifting, coming from a powerlifting background. And we have a very similar squat. Like I think he was squatting 210, 215 at the time. I was squatting around 225, that's kilos. So, mm-hmm. But man, it looked different. He would go into the hole faster and then drop at the last second. And he would bounce out and he would get above my sticking point before it looked like he was exerting muscular force. Mm-hmm. Well, I looked like a girder being slowly like chunka, 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 lowered, hip depth, and then have a slight bounce, but barely, and then grind the shit out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, training background, probably differences in our leverages, all that stuff. We had different sticking points, even though our squats were similar loads. And we had a similar training schedule besides the fact that he came in another four times per week, you know?
Yeah. I can definitely relate to that Olympic lifting background. I mean, I've been doing Olympic lifting since 2005, and on my squats, I never get stuck in the bottom. It's always about halfway up, and it's because I can sort of bounce out of the bottom, but then halfway up when I'm finally starting to grind through it, that's where I always get stuck. You know, so I guess that definitely makes sense. I know in my speakings with Dr. Stuart McGill, he also brought into the idea of anatomy differences in how like a hip socket depth difference could change someone's power. He said that if someone had like a very, very deep hip socket, potentially it would affect their speed off the floor. But then as soon as they pass the knees, you know, that's when their real strength kicks in as they're able to have less impact on the femur hitting the socket edges, you know, near the bottom part of the deadlift or squat.
Absolutely. That's something I didn't even think to include in my presentation. So it is even more in depth than we talked about. Like I talked about the external moment arm.
Yeah.
There's also changes to your internal moment arm. Like if you can imagine your bicep, before I started training, the sucker was half its size, right? Mm-hmm. Which means the tendon insertion was going to be more flat into my elbow and shoulder. And then as this guy gets a little more bulbous, now we've got a tendon angle that's coming down at an angle. So it changes the actual mechanical advantage, if you will, on the inside of my body, not just the distance of my elbow to my shoulder joint. So there is a lot that goes into it. And those are the reasons why we see pretty disparate sticking points, but some general themes.
For sure.
Like you said, in general, if you're talking about powerlifters, you're going to see them come out of the hole and stick on a squat.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about Olympic weightlifters, the stick will be a little bit higher typically because they get more bounce out of the hole and they get more elastic contribution, right?
Makes sense.
If you're talking about a wide grip bench press, like max legal width, that's probably going to be a little bit off the chest. If you see the guys who've had a previous, you know, pec injury or shoulder injury and they're close gripping it, they're going to get it pretty far off their chest and stick high.
Makes sense.
So yeah, that's basically all the contributing factors to a sticking region. But there are probably others, like you brought up that one that I didn't even think of. So
yeah. So just like a lot of things in training, there's a lot of, it depends.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Absolutely. All right.
So now that we have a better definition of what a sticking point is, we understand that there's a lot of variability in those sticking points, depending on a number of different factors. What are some of the ways in which research has shown us and practical experience of ways that we can improve and sort of work through those individual sticking points?
Yeah, this is a tough one because I don't think we have good data. I would say like RCT data. Like we don't have a randomized controlled trial of doing functional isometrics at the sticking point compared to traditional training.
Yeah.
Or bands and chains compared to traditional training, or power training compared to traditional training, or anything like that. There's a little bit on partial range of motion training.
Okay.
There's a pretty cool squat study where they compared full range of motion versus, there's actually a number of studies where they've compared a partial range of motion to a full range of motion, which we'll talk about in a second. But overall, there's a number of proposed solutions, and they're all based on these different mechanisms, which is makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. There is like basically bodybuilding work that's specific to what you think is the weak link in the chain. Because like I said, if you had weak glutes or weak hams or weak quads in a squat, you would supposedly see a sticking point at a different point. Mm-hmm. So there's isolation work, and there's some problems. There's pros and cons to each one of these, which I'll talk about briefly. There's isometrics, which just for the listener, that's a non-moving contraction. So easy way to think of that is you set up the pins in the squat rack, you pull the bench in, and you set the pins like 3 inches off your chest. So you press off your chest, you hit the immovable pins, then you push as hard as you can against that immovable object, and you're doing an isometric contraction. You're working as hard as you can at the point where supposedly you're not producing enough force, right? There is power training, or if you're Louis Simmons, speed work, right? So that's our dynamic effort days, if you will. That's basically trying to improve, even though it's power, I think you're really trying to improve rate of force production, if that's what we're talking about from a way to think perspective.
Yeah.
So that's the rate at which you can generate force. And that has some, the reality is that you reach maximal force output if you're a trained lifter really quickly. We're talking a certain number of milliseconds, right? But that in some cases can be enough to where you don't get to overcome the inertia and you have problems, but it's a pretty limited application, which I'll talk about. Then sort of related to sticking points and sticking regions, we have technique alterations,
okay,
which basically says, hey, screw these crappy biomechanics I have that are giving me the sticking point at this stage in a lift. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to change the game so that my sticking point also changes. And maybe that will be a worthwhile trade-off for my body. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we have accommodating resistance or bands and chains or variable resistance training, like mm-hmm. Depending on what you want to call it. So it's a lot. I think we sort of have to ask the question of, is it even worth going down that rabbit hole?
Yeah.
Some people who are on like the far end of the specificity continuum, which is actually a pretty loud proponent in both Olympic lifting and powerlifting, depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
Like you get the Bulgarian system where it's, we squat, we do clean and jerks, and we snatch. Mm-hmm. And you can't take anything away from them. You can try to blame it all on drugs, but I just don't think that's an adequate explanation. You know,
yeah, they had pretty good results, I think.
Exactly. and then you see the same thing in some corners of powerlifting where it's, we'll do the main lifts and then we'll do the main lifts. And then I'll look at my clock, come back and do some more main lifts, mm-hmm. you know? Excuse me. So, and again, you get written results on both ends of the spectrum. You know, you had, there was periods where ironically, even though, I think in weightlifting, you see a lot more special assistance work in like kind of the Russian blocks. Mm-hmm. When you look at like kind of things like Shiko compared to Westside, now you see something that's a lot more main lift focused versus something where it's a lot more variety and bands and chains and variations in the lifts, but yeah. They would both be at the world championships beating each other every other year and kind of in that 90s to the early 2000s period. So we have this very practical example of you can attack it from either end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And that brings up a really important point is that no matter what you do to try to overcome your sticking region, you're not going to overcome the fact that your muscles are going to have a length tension relationship mm-hmm. and that a lever arm is a fundamental part of the biomechanics and that the longer it is, the harder it's going to be. So your sticking point is always going to be your sticking point.
Makes sense.
Unless it is a technical fault or as a result of an injury. The question is, do you stick at 500 pounds or do you stick at 550? Mm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the path of least resistance towards improving your 1RM?
Yeah.
Right. So, I'll get, this is more about accessory work than it is about a specific lift, but this is a useful example. Like if we accept that the reason you can't deadlift 550 and you're stuck at 500 is your grip strength, would you really just do more deadlifts until your grip strength improved? Or would you schedule one session a week where you take 100% to 120% of your max, pull it out of the rack and hold it for time, and then just work on beating your time?
Yeah.
I think anyone logical would probably do the latter. And I could tell you from experience that doing the latter can fix a grip issue in weeks, while doing a lot of deadlifts probably won't fix your grip issue and might give you a back injury. Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think, like, not always, like, I'm being hyperbolic, but if you can identify a specific problem, you probably want to use a specific solution. And I actually think the idea of being ultra quote unquote specific, when you have a very clear cut one weak link in the chain that you know how to fix, is being general.
Yeah.
Right. So ironically, so anyway, all that said, now let's talk about what might make sense to actually train these sticking regions. So one thing that I think has been underexplored and often done wrong in practice is isometric training. Mm-hmm. If you were thinking, oh yeah, like working at your sticking point, that's why I pause on my deadlift on the way up. I do below the knees because that's where I stick. That's not the same as isometrics. Mm-hmm. And isometric training in the lab is us putting an immovable object there and pulling as hard as we can against it. So the equivalent of that would be setting up in the rack on the deadlift and putting the pins low, like just below your knee, and then getting stopped by the rack and pulling as hard as you can into the pins. But you stopping a bar at your knee is putting out less force, not more, at the point when you're trying to train yourself to explode through a sticking point.
Interesting. Now, if you were to do isometric work, like you said, in a rack like that, how much weight would you technically use on the bar? Like, would you use just the bar and then pull, obviously have it go to the point where you're pulling against the rack and just pull as hard as you can? Or would you even load it with a certain amount on the ground and then pull and then into the rack again?
That's a great question. Because if you do just the bar, it's going to feel really weird at first, and then you're going to stop and have to ramp up your force development, which I think is fine. You can also just put the bar against the rack at that point and then just pull, and then you get this much more nice kind of force curve. Mm-hmm. That's probably the way I would recommend doing it.
Okay.
But you definitely put some load on the bar, or maybe put bands on it, just so that you can actually feel what it's like to pull off the ground and then get stuck. That might have a better motor pattern transfer. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think from a perspective of, you also have to think about, like, how much time do you want to be exerting force against the bar, against the rack rather. And if you load up like 80% of your max, that's going to be hard in and of itself. And then the less than the time you can spend exerting max force against the pins. Mm-hmm. So I personally would just grab a bar and set it touching the place where you want to be, and then have it just be a true isometric there. So that point about you purposefully stopping something is not the same as an isometric. That's kind of like a quasi-isometric. You are contracting, moving, but you're not producing max force at that point. In fact, you're purposefully minimizing your force where the bar would move.
Now, right? Do you think pause deadlifts would have any effect, though, as far as working through a plateau, or not a plateau, a sticking point at the knee? Or just not as efficient as possibly an isometric?
I think it's one of those cases where it's an effective thing to do, but we often do things for rationale that it doesn't make sense, but it works for another reason.
Makes sense.
So I really like pause, and not everyone prescribes pause deadlifts to attack a sticking point. Mm-hmm. They might do it for other reasons. I think as a technical cue, a pause deadlift around or below the knee is a really good idea, because when people, especially in a sumo, do make a technical error, especially at the bottom, the bar gets forward and they have to pull it back. And then that's when you see them get stuck at the top. Mm-hmm. And if you're someone who's trying to generate a lot of force off the floor, like, I don't think everyone should be patient and pull slowly with the sumo deadlift. I think that's generally where I start with technique. I think some people do better with kind of an explosive start off the floor, but if that's you, and the bar gets away from you, then pause deadlifts can be great, because it's difficult to actually pay attention to that fast explosion off the ground and have the motor control to keep the bar back. Mm-hmm. But putting less load on the bar and purposefully pausing at that point just gives you time to actually be aware. That's just motor learning, in my opinion. It's chunking the movement into phases, right?
Yeah.
Which you, as a, from an Olympic lifting background, you know this, like, you'll teach the pull off the ground, you'll teach the pull from the knee to the hip, you'll teach the scoop, mm-hmm. teach the whole movement. You put it all together, and then you can. It's probably easier to learn because it's moving fast.
Yes.
You've got a bar going through the full range of motion. You know, you're going through full flexion and extension with damn near your whole body mm-hmm. when you do an Olympic lift. And trying to keep it all in your head when you're in the learning phase, first pull, second pull, third pull, fourth pull. It's like, oh my God, what's going on? So chunking it makes sense. That's why you bring the blocks out. You do snatches mm-hmm. from the knees, cleans, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I think the same thing can be said for while the way less technical lifts, the power lifts, I think a sumo deadlift is on the more technical side of them. And being in the right position off the floor, not losing your balance at the top, getting your hips through and timing it so that your knees lock out just slightly before your hips, which seems to be the best way to do a sumo pull. Mm-hmm. All of that together, does take some intense motor learning, and that might be improved by pausing at certain points. But I don't think that's because of a sticking region. I think that's to correct technical faults.
Makes sense. And I know I've definitely programmed in for others and for myself pauses at the knee or at mm-hmm. certain other parts of the lift for that reason, for more of that motor learning, time under tension, understanding sort of, you know, checking yourself. Is the bar where it needs to be? Am I staying balanced? Is the tension where it needs to be placed? Now go kind of thing. So definitely more so of a check for technique and improving the pull and the coordination off the ground. Now, if someone was to do the isometrics, is there any research at all or practical application experience in how long that isometric should be for efficient carryover? Like, are we talking a 10-second isometric? Are we talking 30 seconds or longer?
I think, you know, from what we know of how long it takes to hit max force, it doesn't need to be that long at all.
Okay.
I do think, though, that, like, this should probably be additional volume. It probably shouldn't replace something because okay. if you're doing, let's say, you know, 5x5, and then a 3x10 and then a 5x3, like let's say that's for a lift, what you do in a week mm-hmm. and you decide to replace one of those sessions with isometrics, you might actually see a degradation or no change because you're getting very little morphological adaptations out of, let's say 3x5 seconds of isometric training or something like that. So to answer your question, I think any more than 5 or 10 seconds is probably overdoing it. You've definitely hit max force. You're feeling the position out. I think that gives you time to pay attention. You could go longer, but if you just think about the specificity of how long is a lift actually going to last and how long are you going to be in that sticking point. And then if you look at the science of, well, how long does it actually take to hit max force? Yeah, it's like 3 to 5 seconds at most.
Gotcha.
So I would say no more than 10 seconds and you can do a few sets of that. Mm-hmm. The rest periods don't need to be that long. Because it's just a much less energetic contraction. And I would tack it onto the top of something because if you replace other volume, then something that might've been actually stimulating hypertrophy or giving you more direct carryover to the full movement, if it's getting replaced, I could see that actually being a not worthwhile trade-off.
You know, and that actually makes sense a lot. I know specifically in the rehab side of things, when we're dealing with things like patellar or quad tendinopathy, often we'll throw in, some isometrics in the early stage, like Spanish squats. Usually mm-hmm. we do that, like at least based on a lot of Jill Cook's research, 5 sets of 45 seconds, sitting in the Spanish squat as far as a helpful way to modify pain. But
yes.
yet you have to then move on to the isotonic work, strength work after, whether that's with like a heavy, slow resistance, Bulgarian split squat or a box squat, because the isometric alone won't be enough to stimulate the strength response that we're looking for to increase the load tolerance, which was the reason why the tendinopathy originally appeared. So it would make sense that we wouldn't want to use an isometric to improve a sticking point as a lift itself, but as a supplement in an assistant exercise afterwards.
Aaron, I'm really glad you said that because I think people often assume when they see a lifter doing something in the gym mm-hmm. that there's only one reason to be doing it and therefore there's only one way to be doing it.
Yeah,
absolutely. And this is much more your area than mine because I'm not a physical therapist. Isometrics have a role in tendinopathy, injury rehab, and maybe even prevention. I don't know. That's mm-hmm. not my area. And the way you perform them is going to look a lot different because there's a different underlying rationale. We're not trying to work on force production at a sticking point. Mm-hmm. You're trying to actually create a loading and then adaptive response that will prevent pain and get you back in the gym lifting heavier again. So yeah, if you see a lifter doing isometrics for 45 seconds, don't think, hey, you're an idiot. Eric Helms on the podcast said no more than 10 seconds. Yeah. No, they might have tendon pain. So that could be a very different rationale. So that's great.
It's all about why you're doing something. There's all, you know, you have to have that why to back up. All right. So let's do this. Let's move on. The next area you talked about, I think were partial reps.
Yeah. Partials. So cool thing about isometrics and partial ranges of motion is that we know there's basically at any joint angle that there's just this continuum of transfer as that to adjacent joint angles. Right. So if you do isometrics at, you know, right here on the chest, it's going to probably improve you a little bit below and above that, you know, so let's say plus or minus 5 to 10 degrees, if I had to put a number on it. And that's not like, you know, one of the 10 commandments or anything like that. But, same thing is true in a dynamic contraction. So if you look at all the studies, the overall takeaway is that if you train partial range of motion squats, you're going to get stronger at that partial range of motion almost exclusively, but at least primarily. If you train a full range of motion, because that includes the partial range of motion, you get stronger at both partials and full range. Some people will use that as an argument to say, well, then why would I ever train partial range of motion? I should just train full. Mm-hmm. Well, there's also a few studies that show maybe combining both might even be better for certain types of sports performance. So we need more data on this, but especially if someone has a pronounced sticking region, there's certainly an argument for supplementing your full range of motion training with doing some partials around that sticking region. Now, that's kind of the pros, the theoretical rationale. Some of the cons around both isometric and partial range of motion training is that your sticking point is not actually where you're the weakest. That's where you can see and notice that you're the weakest. And the analogy I like to use is if an animal jumps out in front of your car and you slam on your brakes, you don't just stop on a dime immediately. You hope that getting to a stop gives the animal enough time to get out of the way because you know that momentum is going to carry you forward. And the sticking point is the equivalent point to when your car actually stops. But the point when you've actually reduced force is equivalent to the point where you slam on the brakes.
Makes sense.
Now, if you had like a 3D camera and like an LPT set up, you could get the exact point when your force production started to drop off or when velocity started to drop off. But when you're looking at a video or when your coach is looking at you, it is a bit of a guessing game. No. And if you use the actual point where you actually stick, that's not really where you need to be training. I mean, theoretically, it makes a lot more sense. You need to train the point before that where, you know, you start slamming on the brakes. So there is guesswork involved here. So if you're going to the gym on your own, or if your coach is programming and tells you, here's where to do the isometric or here's where to do the partial, you might not be training in the right spot. So the transfer is a little iffy. It's kind of guesswork. So I think what makes the most sense is probably have a few different isometric spots that are around that sticking region. You do a few sets at each, kind of play it safe. Mm-hmm. And then for your partial, don't do really tiny partials. I would say do like, you know, a full third of the range of motion or a quarter at least, that you work on that, you know, shit, my sticking region should be somewhere in here. And then you can overload that a little more and get some preferential volume dedicated towards that range of motion. And that probably will increase the likelihood of that being effective. And again, I think just kind of bring that, the big picture thing. And I talked about, you know, let's say a weekly training program where you got your 5x5, your 3x10 and your 5x3. And then you add in one session of 5 isometrics. That's a very small portion of your total training. And I think that's kind of how you should look at all of these strategies, is they should be with a solid backbone of the basic training, not completely replacing everything. So I'm not a big fan of kind of the West Side approach where it's like, last time I pulled a regular competition deadlift was in 1985. You know, I only did bands and chains or rack partials with the alligator bar. Like, alligator bar? I haven't heard of that one. It's like, well, the Buffalo bar sold out. So.
Now, when you're talking partials, like especially if we're talking about the squat, are we talking pin squats? Are we talking box squats? Or are there any specific, I guess, best practices for doing the partial that you found the most effective?
I think those can all work. There's a slight difference. So if you do a pin squat, you're typically starting with a concentric, right?
Yeah.
You're wedging yourself underneath the bar and you're just going straight up. So that is going to be a little less specific than, let's say, a box squat, where you precede it with the eccentric and then do the concentric. Mm-hmm. I personally think, since you're not going to get stuck on the eccentric, there's nothing wrong with doing just the concentric. But that's probably fine if you have a relatively high stick. Mm-hmm. But if you're getting stuck somewhere out of the hole, you probably want to have that preceding eccentric to kind of more mimic it. So my bias is towards being a little more specific. I think if you can, if it's in a squat, you probably want to do that preceding eccentric, but I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing it. And this is all, unfortunately, this is guesswork. You know, yeah. I can't confidently state that a box squat is better than a pin squat. And I could think of different rationale for each. My phone is on, apologies. So I think it totally depends on the situation, the lifter, where the stick is, the equipment available.
Yeah.
And you could also not use either one. You know, mm-hmm. you could just do squats that make people angry, you know, not full range of motion, right? Yeah. So you could just go out of the gym. Yeah, I mean, for the most part, the reason I'd recommend getting a box out is just so that powerlifters and Olympic lifters don't give you the stink eye. Right.
And you don't end up on like quarter squat gang on Instagram or something like
exactly,
that.
Right. You can put your video up on YouTube and you won't get as many negative comments. You'll get some because it's YouTube.
That's true.
Yeah. But you won't have people slagging you off because there's a physical object preventing you from going to that. So it looks intentional.
Yeah. Love it. All right. So let's go to the next one, which is probably one of the most popular, I think, is the accommodating resistance with bands and chains. Let's first dive in just quickly. What is sort of the science behind accommodating resistance? Because that's obviously a big, huge word that a lot of people just sort of goes right over their head.
Yeah. So fortunately I laid some groundwork here talking about the length tension relationship and the passive and active components of muscle. Mm-hmm. You lay those on top of each other in a dynamic action. And then you take the individual biomechanics of a lift and you have what's called the strength curve, or the force curve. And different lifts have different curves where you're going to be stronger or weaker. And in general, when you look at the power lifts, they get easier as you complete the range of motion, mm-hmm. right? So accommodating resistance basically flips that on its head a little bit and says, hey, if I put a band on the bar and loop it on the ground, you're going to have the least band resistance when you're in the hole, when normally you're the weakest, and the most band resistance towards the top when normally you're the strongest. So the strength curve is now quote unquote accommodated so that it smooths it out so that it's harder throughout the whole lift. As an example, let's say you can squat 500 and you put 315 on the bar. That's pretty light, right? Yeah. That's, you know, 60% of your one RM. You might be able to do 20 reps if you're feeling sadistic that day. Mm-hmm. But then you put another 50, 60 pounds of band tension on there. And now you're actually got something where you're working with maybe 8 reps or something like that. Mm-hmm. And now the bottom feels pretty hard because it's always hard. And there's at least 315 on the bar, maybe a little bit of band tension. So we'll say 320, 330-ish. Mm-hmm. And then as you get higher and higher and higher and get you close to lockout, you've actually got 370, 360, 375, somewhere like that at a point that is normally that 315 that would be even easier, but it's actually getting harder. Mm-hmm. Same kind of thing with chains. As each link comes off the ground, it adds more load to the bar. So as you're at the deepest portion of the squat or the bench or the bottom of the deadlift, all the chain is just lying on the ground. And as the bar goes up, harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. So that's accommodating resistance. Now, to get directly to the point of what we're talking about, the reason why that might be useful is for someone who has a sticking point in the latter portion of a lift, because it allows you to preferentially load the latter portion of the lift. It's also useful because it's more similar to the actual movement itself than I would argue as a partial or as an isometric or than a pin squat or something that starts with just the concentric. So you get the full natural range of motion. It just has a more variable resistance than you're used to. Another way that accommodating resistance can be useful, and this requires me to talk about power training or speed work, mm-hmm. is that if you think about it, if you just put, say, 40% of 1RM on the bar and you try to explode that off your chest as much as you can, your back will actually jump off the pad. You'll lose your tuck, you'll lose your arch. Mm-hmm. Or you would, if you really wanted to keep accelerating that bar as much as you could in a squat, you would do a jump squat. You'd leave the ground. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be leaving the ground or having your back jump off the pad when you're doing a 1RM or anything heavy. So what that requires you to do to keep it similar to the motion that you're trying to transfer to is to actually start decelerating the bar. And you will do this naturally without even thinking about it. You'll do an explosive rep, and then once you're about two-thirds of the way up, you got to slow it down so you don't lose position and jump off the pad. And that's arguably not what you want to be doing when you're trying to improve power and force, you know, which, you know, force is mass times acceleration. You know, power is work over time and involves, you know, or force times velocity. So deceleration is the opposite of what you want to do, right?
Yeah.
So, however, if you put bands on the bar and now load 30% of your 1RM or 40% of your 1RM, now as you can keep trying to accelerate while the load is going up, and you are not prevented by your natural need to decelerate the bar. And there's actually some very new research just came out in the last couple months showing that, yeah, it does that. It allows you to keep accelerating. So the logic has proof in the pudding, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So now to kind of take a step back, logical rationale for accommodating resistance. Not a lot of strong research behind it. We kind of have equivocal results. Mm-hmm. There was a meta-analysis that actually showed accommodating resistance on average improved strength more than normal resistance training. But that actually got, there's a letter to the editor where they said, hey, we had an error in our meta-analysis here. Hmm. And it doesn't show, there's no significant difference between the two.
Interesting.
So that took a lot of wind out of the sails for accommodating resistance proponents. However, most of those studies are A or B. That's the thing about science. It never tells you is A plus B better. It just tells you is A better than B.
Yeah.
And if A is equivalent to B, there's certainly an argument remaining that says A plus B could be even better. And I think if we're talking about a specific scenario where someone's got difficulty in lockout and using accommodating resistance, that would be logical to me as a way to improve that sticking region.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, there's a lot of research out there that, I mean, in order to have a research article, you have to say, is this mm-hmm. better than this? But in the real world, why can't we say, let's do both? I mean, there's 7 days in the week. How many days of training are you having? Why not do both a full lift and then one day have some accommodating resistance and just see how that works for your individual body, your level of training, and where you're at? Do you make any change with that way of training versus two regular days of lifting, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's exactly the way you need to look at research.
Yeah.
So I think pretty strong rationale for accommodating resistance out of everything we've talked about. It makes a lot of sense. It's probably a little more specific. Then we have power training. Like, well, great. So I can use a band to prevent me from decelerating the bar, but should I even be doing 40% explosively? Is that going to transfer very well to main lift? The answer is probably not for everyone.
Yeah.
So there was a pretty cool study that came out last year where they were looking at changes in rate of force development. Mm-hmm. And they found there are what's called power responders and force responders, or quote unquote normal responders, and that basically doing dynamic effort work in a subsection of this group of participants in this study was the most effective way and the only way actually in this time restricted study where they improved their rate of force production. And in the other group, it was not effective at all, and it was a waste of time, and just going heavy improved their rate of force production. That's really interesting and frustrating. Because we don't have any way of predicting that. We just know that it's a thing. Mm-hmm. But there's a question even underneath that. Is rate of force production something that we need to focus on as powerlifters? And the answer is in most cases, probably not. Because like I said, it takes, 400, 500 milliseconds before you've reached max force production. So that means that for power training to be effective for you as a way of defeating a sticking region, one, you need to be a power responder. Mm-hmm. And then two, you need to have a sticking point that's really early in a lift. We're talking like on the chest, barely off the chest and bench, on the floor on a deadlift, or like not bouncing out of the hole and getting stuck, but in the hole getting stuck right when you're starting to change to a concentric. People are out there who do that. I have seen that, but it's certainly not common. But it's worth a shot. So if you're someone who has really, really early stick points in the big three, you could make an argument for trying power training instead of just regular heavy training to see if it helps you. And then in the case of doing that kind of power training with 40% of 1RM explosively for, say, like a bunch of triples, you probably want to put some bands or chains on there just so that you're not decelerating. And that's kind of the limited utility of power training I'd recommend. And then in general, if you want to use accommodating resistance, I think you can use more moderate loads. Nothing wrong with putting 60, 70, 80% of the bar and putting a little additional load from accommodating resistance and just doing heavy training with more of the load bias towards the top.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Well, I think that's about close to an hour today. I think we covered a lot of stuff. I think I'm definitely going to have you back on the show so we can talk way more of the science of training and just nerd out on stuff, because today's episode was just awesome. I think we gave the listeners a lot of stuff to think about and things that they can take and practically apply to their training. Where can people find more about you on social media?
Well, first, thank you for having me. I'd love to be back on. And I think the best place to find me is 3dmusclejourney.com. That is the number 3, the letter D, musclejourney.com. And that's kind of a one-stop hub to get to the rest of my content. You can find my books there, links to Mass. We got our blog, our podcast, all of our free content that's there. If you want daily stuff, follow me at Helms3DMJ on Instagram. I try to put out actually meaningful content, even though it is Instagram. It is possible. And then lastly, my new podcast with Omar Isif, Iron Culture, where we explore the history, science, and culture of lifting and try to bring people together from everywhere, from calisthenics to CrossFit to bodybuilding, powerlifting, Olympic lifting. Definitely check that out. And we have our own Instagram at the Iron Culture Podcast, and we have our YouTube, and you can find us on iTunes and Spotify as well.
Awesome. Well, everyone out there listening, go and follow Eric on all those different platforms. Listen to his other podcast that he just talked about. And yeah, thank you so much for being on the show. For everyone out there listening, if you would please share this show around on Instagram, tag me on it. It would mean a lot to me. Until next week, guys, happy squatting.
That's it for today, class, on Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horschig. For more exclusive content, log on to squatuniversity.com.